Welcome to the dog-friendly edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. We begin the show today with an excerpt of my interview with cognitive scientist Alexandra Horowitz. She's the director of the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College, where she studies dog-human play, olfactory discrimination of dogs, the meanings behind barking, and the social life of dogs. She joined me in 2009 to discuss how dogs think, which she explored in her book, Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell, and Know. Let's take a listen. Well, let's put some basic information on the table here. What is a dog, genetically speaking?
A dog is a member of the carnivore family and the canid subfamily, and this includes all sorts of other dog-like creatures, wolves, coyotes, are familiar members of this family, and they are the domesticated and only domesticated version of the canid family.
In fact, you say that they have very high levels of, maybe this is a human word, but social cognition. I mean, if you live with a dog, you see that.
Yeah, exactly. What's become interesting about studying dogs from a research and academic perspective is that they're much better at tests of what we call social cognition, in other words, figuring out what other animate creatures are doing and predicting their behavior, than even other primates, even chimpanzees.
What does that tell you?
That indicates that they're well-suited to humans, that some part of our, what we consider to be a human ability of cooperation and understanding of each other, is not just genetically encoded, so not necessarily in other primates, but also is inculcated, is part of our culture.
I mentioned by talking about beagles having 300 million receptor sites in their noses, giving an obvious indication about the ability of dogs to have an acute sense of smell. But help us understand even the kind of breathing that dogs do that helps them sort of smell in this world that we share with them, but we just have no idea about.
Right. I think we all know that dogs smell well, right? But I was surprised even at finding how acute their sense of smell was and how it must change their whole experience. And the example of inhaling and exhaling is a nice way to see how it diverges from our inhale and exhaling. We breathe in and then through one nostril and breathe out through the same nostril, and any smell that goes in has to be kind of exhaled before we can get another whiff of it. But dogs actually breathe differently, inhale differently, so that as they have inhaled air, they push exhale out the slits in the side of their noses. And this exhale allows for the inhale of more air that might contain odors, and also creates a little wind, a little vortex, which encourages more air to be inhaled. So they continuously see through their sniffing, whereas we sniff in little bursts.
So when you take your dog for a walk, I mean, we have our own experience of what it's like to walk our dog, but I'm wondering from their experience, what is a walk for them?
It's an interesting question. My guess is that it's a number of things. One, it's a very exciting opportunity to smell the world. So they spend most of the day in a relatively cloistered olfactory environment. Smells are moving through a room in the day, but there are not a lot of new smells coming in unless the windows are wide open. So going outside is seeing a great vista of smells. It's a social opportunity, and it's a social opportunity with you. You have a chance to interact with your dog, and they're very alert to your responses to them in that time, sometimes more alert than at home. And it's a social opportunity to see who has been out,
right,
not just the dogs who were there and they're going to encounter, but who has left marks, repeatedly down the street, and smell what's up ahead of them, smell who is coming. So I think it's a pretty exciting time for them.
Well, and I have a dog, and I'm sure anyone has their times. It seems like they are these little smell detectives. It's like a blade of grass, and he's just
absolutely
sniffing it, every nook and cranny of that blade of grass.
Yeah, and I don't think I can even quite imagine how rich that the information from that blade of grass might be. But something that has touched it, that has stepped on it, something, a molecule from someone's sandwich earlier in the day that has landed there, that information, in theory, can be detected by their nose, by those 300 million receptors. So it's information for them. It's not just an ordinary blade of grass.
And just to add to this, you also say that dogs can smell time or sort of tell time through smell, and I wonder if you could talk about that.
This is part of what I tried to do, was use the science to then, as I say, evoke what the experience of dogs might be like. And if your primary sense is smell, you realize some interesting things about smell. Well, one, smell exists in time. That is, an odor is going to be more concentrated if it's just applied to a surface than if it was applied 10 minutes before or an hour before or a day before. And so dogs can detect that difference. This is how tracking dogs tell the difference, tell which way somebody's run away. They know the difference between the right foot, which went down half a second before the left foot. So they know, based on the difference in concentrations of odor, which direction the person has fled. Well, that essentially means that they're detecting something which is a little further back in time and something which happened more recently. That's as though they're seeing a wider window of the present time than we are, it seems to me, when they smell something.
Let me just move on with you, Alexander, from the nose to the eyes. You say dogs' eyes are very structurally very different from humans' eyes. Describe how they work.
There is a way in which they're similar, but they're organized so that they don't see terribly well, at least not most breeds, right in front of them. And they're much more attuned to quick motion, hence their ability to see something running out of the bushes, say. But you often notice that a dog won't see something right in front of it. You know, you put a toy right by the dog's paws, and the dog looks at you with puzzlement, not able to find the toy. That's because they just don't have the same number of retinal cells right in the middle of their eyes as we do, so that we can focus on the book that's put right in front of us.
You say that one thing that makes a dog different from a wolf is that dogs make eye contact.
Yeah, in many species, including wolves, eye contact is a threat. So wolves won't stare at each other, continuously locking gaze, unless one means to give a threat to the other. And usually eye contact will result in aggression. So it's quite a profound difference for the dog to stare at our faces. And in any other context, that would be viewed as a threat by us or by them.
So they want to know what we're doing. What are they looking for, do you think?
I think that what it turns out they're able to see by looking at our face is what our attention is, whether our attention is on them, if we're indicating where we're going with our gaze, or maybe they can get information from us, like where we put that toy out of their reach or where we've hidden the food. So the side effect of their bothering to look at our faces, and it might have initially been an accidental trait that early dogs had, is that they're able to get information from our faces. And, of course, that's appealing to us because that's how we deal with each other.
You also say, and this is really, I think, counter to a prevailing theory, I don't know how popular it still is, that when humans live with dogs, that dogs look to that human being as the pack leader. You really challenge that. How do you see the relationship between dogs and humans then?
I do challenge that, and this comes entirely from research looking at wild wolf behavior. These researchers say that wild wolves, though they live in a pack, their life is not one fueled by fighting to get to the top of the hierarchy. Instead, packs are usually almost all related individuals, so a mated pair, a male and female, and then generations of their offspring. So in some way, that mated pair, the parents, are the alpha pair. But no one else is competing with them to be at the top.
So when you look at dogs and humans together, is it a couple?
Right. I think it's a family. I think
it's
family is a good way, or I sort of describe in the book as a gang, like a benign gang. We're all sort of friends. We don't even have to be in a position of parent and child. But either of those analogies work better.
I wrestle whether dogs love us or they're little furry psychopaths and they're just using us.
Well, it might be a little of both, right?
But we, you know, this gaze that you talk about, I mean, we associate that with love, right? Our dog loves us, and we come home, and they're so happy to see us.
That's true, and I do think affection is part of the relationship that we have with dogs. And now, how the dog would define that? Well, we have to admit it would be different than how we define it for the dog. My love for my pooch is different than his love for me. in fundamental ways, but I don't doubt that he loves me, and there's a huge amount of his behavior which indicates that he does. I mean, he wants to affiliate with me, always comes back to me. Am I also a food source for him? Yes, but that doesn't mean that he doesn't have affection.
And you also write about dog hearing, and of course, we know a little bit about, at least as outsiders, about how they hear the world, but help us understand what you know about how dogs hear the world.
Sure. They have actually, in some ways, a similar hearing range to ours, but they can hear much higher frequencies. So that explains the success of the inaudible dog whistle being picked up by dogs. This does mean, too, that they can hear types of sounds that we might not even think make sounds, are sounds at all. There are sounds in typical alarm clock or in fluorescent bulbs, which might be very annoying to a dog because it's a constant little hum to them, which we never hear. What they can't do with hearing, which we actually do a little better, is use sound to localize the source of the sound. So they'll hear something and they'll get alert. You know, if you call your dog when you're out and off-leash, have them off-leash in an open space, you might notice that they'll recognize that their name is being called. They'll perk their ears, but they might not run immediately to you. In fact, they might run the opposite direction. They need smell or sight to accompany hearing before they can really identify where the source of the sound is.
I've noticed a lot of people talk to their dogs the way they talk to their children, with kind of higher, more sort of squeaky voices. Is that helpful to a dog?
It really is. It helps them to distinguish that sound from all the other yammering that's going on around them. We're constantly talking around them. Most of it is not directed to them. So by using a higher pitched voice, kind of what's called motherese or baby talk, although some people might think it's silly, it actually is helpful in getting the dog's attention.
It almost sounds like dogs know us better than we know them.
In some ways, I think of them as anthropologists of human behavior because they sit there and eavesdrop on us most of the day. Now imagine if you had somebody else across the room sitting and watching you as you work at the computer or you work at your veterinary hospital and observing what behaviors come before other behaviors and seeing what the indication is that they're about to give you a treat or that they're about to leave the room, et cetera. I mean, they become extremely good observers of us. But because we seem to already come to ownership of dogs, knowing what dogs are all about and feeling like dogs act in X, Y, and Z ways, sometimes we don't look at what they're actually doing as well as we could.
That was my 2009 interview with cognitive scientist Alexandra Horowitz about her book Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell, and Know. When we get back from our break, Cats on Dogs. We'll hear from author John Katz about the emotional work of dogs. Stay with us.
I'm a dog, 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 I'm a dog,
I'm a dog.
This is Radio Times in Review, the Dog Edition. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We continue our look at dogs by revisiting my conversation with author John Katz. He's written extensively about our four-legged friends over the years and joined me in 2003 to discuss his book, The New Work of Dogs, Tending to Life, Love, and Family. The book documents several stories of people who have relied on dogs for emotional support and examines the transition of dogs from worker to confidant. Let's take a listen to an excerpt of my interview with author John Katz. Describe how you love your dogs.
Well, I think I would be embarrassed, I think, probably to tell you all the details of how I love my dog. My daughter always says that if I love my dogs anymore, we'd have some problems. But it's funny, in the course of loving them, I also, as you know, was confronted with a high-strung, complicated dog, which a lot of us have. Some people call this the lifetime dog. Some people call it their heart. My wife calls him Satan's spawn. But he had so many different issues and difficulties. I ended up in the hands of a trainer from Pennsylvania, named Carolyn Wilkie out in Bangor. In one of our first encounters, I remember saying to her, which I hear a lot of people say, you know, this dog is so attached to me that if anything happened to me, you'd have to shoot this dog because he couldn't live with anybody else. And I remember Carolyn grabbing me by the collar and said, listen, bub, if anything happened to you, I would go buy a pound of beef liver, and in 2 days, this dog would forget that you ever walked the earth, and don't you forget it. That's the beginning of your training. And, of course, you know, I love my dogs dearly, and I know they love me. I have two border collies. But the truth of what she said just went off like a rocket in my head because I realized what I was doing, and she pointed this out to me. I was seeing this dog as a rebellious teenager, as an earlier version of myself, as a complicated, difficult, defiant. I was seeing him in human terms. When she pointed out to me, the problem was I just didn't know enough about dogs to train him properly. It was my problem, not his problem. And the University of Kentucky got in touch with me after A Dog Year came out, and they studied the human-animal bond and attachment theory. My family was thrilled that a psychiatrist had sort of entered the picture at this point.
They felt you needed it.
I needed this. They were very happy. But they said, look, your book was a classic example of attachment therapy and attachment theory, so I studied that a bit and then picked these 12 people in my town. And I found that, of course, the issues we often bring from our own lives and we project them onto the dogs, sometimes it's wonderful and sometimes it's not so wonderful. And I was surprised by how complicated the turf I found myself.
But what you're saying is that if this dog that you love dearly, that you think loves you, could be lured away with just some liver and a pat on the head, are you saying, or do people believe that the dogs are not these all loving creatures that we invite into our world, but they're using us?
Well, it would be a pound of liver.
They're social parasites.
Well, John Archer, the great British psychologist who spent his life obsessed, he loves dogs, as do I, and he was obsessed with this question of why do we love dogs so much? We're very rough on other species. We don't treat any other species except for cats the way we treat dogs, maybe horses. And why do we do this? In a Darwinian sense, it doesn't really make sense. We don't really need them. And he said the reason we do is that dogs, and he meant this in a very benign way, that dogs are the world's most effective social parasites, that they show a range of emotions, certainly affection, hostility, neediness, anxiety, and they thus trick us into thinking they have all of the emotions, and we then attach to them like crazy. And we project in different ways. You know, I saw some wonderful, the University of Kentucky sent me truckloads of studies about all this, and one of the ones I love was about the gender differences in pets and dogs. And the one I love, one of them was women attach to dogs because they project these very complicated emotional relationships. Men attach to dogs because they don't talk. And they have the perfect buddy. They have the silent friend they've always wanted. They don't have to speak to. But in a lot of these cases, what's been happening in recent years is we see our dog, we refer to ourselves as mommy and daddy, and dogs. We see the dogs as more human-like. Some people told me they saw the dogs as children with fur. We get dogs when we get divorced. We get dogs when we get laid off. We get dogs when we get depressed. So they're starting to do a lot of emotional work. We're putting a lot on them. I see people refer about dog mystics and supernatural, and they talk to the dogs in the past. They see dogs as being empathic and spiritual and telepathic. And some of these things can be true at times. I mean, I've had experiences with my dogs I would certainly describe as spiritual, very powerful. But at the same time, I sort of learned under this great trainer and my own research that I wasn't doing my dogs a favor by seeing them as versions of myself. I needed to understand they were dogs and they needed to be treated like animals.
But do you think that people's relationship with dogs are really that different? Because I certainly remember growing up with dogs when they were this beast that I would confide in, or had friends that where the dogs really played such a central role in their life because I didn't feel love and affection from
sure.
the
well,
adults
that's very,
in their
very
life.
Typical. What's old is the relationship between humans and dogs. It's 20,000 years old at least. Dogs, of course, were used for more utilitarian reasons. They were used for security or for protection. 30 years ago, you didn't rescue a dog. You just got a dog. And the dog usually ran free. You didn't clean up after the dog. You didn't leash the dog. You didn't get a dog from a breeder. You didn't give the dog a human name. The dog rarely slept in bed. And it wasn't that you didn't love it or that you didn't care about it or that dogs didn't play a part in your life. But from the 60s on, really, it dates from the rise of television where Americans began spending more and more time indoors and at home. Meeting people was harder. The extended family sharply declined. Kids moved away and families scattered. Work became insecure for people. It became increasingly difficult to find these open common spaces where people could meet each other. And life became stressful and more fragmented. The dog population in 1960 in the United States was about 15 million owned dogs. Today it's nearly 70 million owned dogs, plus 10 million dogs in the shelter system. There's this very new rescue culture, the idea of the abused dog, the idea of the Disney dog, which the media projects all the time, the dog who will crawl 700 miles through the Arctic tundra to find you if you lose him, when, of course, you know, as I learned from a bunch of trainers, my dog, if I lost him, would go to a deli and he would stay there for as long as the deli owner gave him food. Right. Now, this isn't to take away from our love, my love, their love for me, whatever. We're very connected and disturbingly so sometimes. But I wanted to know the truth about it. I didn't want to make the dog into something other than a dog.
But are you saying that we are really, because we're asking dogs and we're inviting them into our beds, into our family life, that we're asking them to carry some of the emotional life of the family,
absolutely,
the emotional burdens of the family?
Absolutely.
And that's really an unfair request.
Well,
it's
not always an unfair. It's often quite wonderful. I mean, some people are using dogs, elderly people, lonely people, depressed, in amazingly wonderful ways. Dogs are really helping people to an astonishing degree. I saw some wonderful, happy, heartwarming stories that I described. Dogs helping people to be alone, helping people. And they do help with depression. They do help get people moving. And they are very loving. The problem I saw was when people begin to lose the perspective between where the dog ends and the human begins. You know, I think any trainer will tell you this, that there are more aggressive, neurotic, and troubled dogs than ever by the millions. We all see the dog that people can't leave alone, mm-hmm, have separation anxiety, mm-hmm, about. People can't train. Only 3-5% of Americans train their dogs. My argument is not at all, or my feeling is not at all, to not love your dog. Love your dog as much as you want. But I think when you lose the idea of the dog as not being a person, or see it as increasingly human-like with emotions, the dogs start to get into trouble because they're not trained. They're not really shown. I mean, my mission, I realized with my border collie, was I needed to show him how to live in a world that really isn't suitable for dogs in many ways. All the things dogs like to do, run free, roll in disgusting stuff, squabble with each other, have sex, are either illegal or frowned upon. So we have to show dogs how to live in the world we've created for them, much as we love them. And we don't. So few people really ever even train their dogs. So this is causing a host of anti-dog trouble.
Well, you even say that if people were more serious about training their dogs, you could have dogs more running free. You could,
absolutely,
get rid of leash laws.
I'd much rather see training laws than leash laws, because it would really be less necessary. But, of course, the non-dog-owning population, which is 60% of the country, is really up in arms about millions of dogs running around, and pooping all over the place, and jumping on people, and sometimes being inappropriate. And so by not training dogs, we're actually putting them at risk. And we're asking our dogs to lead completely unnatural lives because their behaviors are so unpredictable that society is promulgating a wave of anti-dog legislation.
So we're keeping them home alone. We're taking them, if we do at all, on a leash for a walk.
We rarely train them.
So we're not
showing them
how
to live in the world.
Right. And you say really the work of dogs is work.
The work of dogs is work, and the work of dogs can certainly be tending to emotional lives, can certainly be keeping you company. It's a great use of dogs, and they're doing amazing work in terms of people's. Yeah. But we, in a society as fragmented and disconnected as ours, we're turning with the intensity of the relationships is what I saw was breathtaking. Mm-hmm. People telling me what their dogs were thinking, many people telling me they got more emotional support from dogs than from the people they live with. I heard that all the time. I spent researching the book a day a week in my vet's office in my town. And she warned me, she said, you know, as a man, it's going to be tough on you. And I said, what do you mean? And I saw what she meant, that woman after woman came into that vet's office and said, look, I don't care what happens to my husband. You've got to keep this dog alive. I can't live without this dog. And it wasn't even that the marriages were bad or that the husbands were bad. It's that people were just not getting enough emotional support and were turning to dogs for it, which says something about our culture that I think is interesting. What raises new issues? I saw 6 dogs who were on respirators who had terminal degrees of cancer and were on life support systems at $1,000 a week because the people just couldn't let go.
Right.
This was very troubling to the vets who said this is not what they wanted to be doing.
But do you think it also reflects just the intensity with which we raise our children, we go to work, we take care of our homes?
Yes.
Clean our cars. I mean, that everyone is living at this high pitch.
I see it as a boomer variant. You know, I've always sort of been drawn to writing about the boomers. And the boomers created the idea of the gifted and talented child. And now they're creating the idea of the gifted and talented dog. And in our readings, we know that my dogs and I have been going all across the country. We've been having a wonderful time talking to dog lovers. But I know I hear all the time, one woman came up to me in Milwaukee and said, you know, Mondays we do obedience and Tuesday we do agility and Wednesdays we're herding and Thursdays and Fridays are open. And what are we going to do? And I said, well, how about just like letting the dog lie around the yard for a bit? That to me is the red zone. I felt I was getting into it, and I also saw it. The notion of letting a dog be a dog. A man told me that his dog was telepathic because the dog knew when it was time to go out before he did. Why not just have a great dog? Why does the dog have to be a psychic?
Be special.
Why does it have to be that special?
This book you did the research basically in your own backyard in Montclair, New Jersey, which you call Dogville, USA.
In studying the American Veterinary Association demographics, Montclair perfectly mirrors the dog-owning population, which tends to be, interestingly, more affluent and better educated as a whole than the population at large.
That's interesting.
Dogs are expensive, and it particularly draws educated people. And I also, because I wanted to spend a year with people and their dogs, I needed to be close because I couldn't do that much traveling. So I found people in different walks of life. I went to vet's offices, pet stores, hung around these trails, bothered people, and found some wonderful people in very powerful, wrenching, and happy situations with dogs.
Well, one that really spoke to me was the story about the woman who her husband had left her. She had cancer, and
Donna and
this dog had this really wonderful relationship, and they would sing together.
She wrote songs for Harry all the time and would sing to him, and he... You know, I love corgis because I can't look at a corgi without smiling. Yeah. It's just something in their face that just brings that out. And Donna was dying of cancer. She had terminal cancer, which was spreading. Her husband is having so much trouble with it that they both agreed that he should leave. He really couldn't. He just couldn't handle it. And her friends were sort of melting away. She was disfigured. She was having a very tough time. And she chose to end her life with Harry, the corgi.
Yeah.
And the two of them just were extraordinary. Now, I had to say, I had many long discussions with her about this. It bothered me a little bit. I said, you know, are you sure you really want to end your life this way with a corgi, however wonderful we know him to be? And she said, look, this dog loves me unconditionally. He loves me uncritically. He doesn't care what I look like. He doesn't care what I smell like. He doesn't care if I'm throwing up, which was true. The dog was unbelievably vigilant and faithful and attentive. She died. And I was involved in her decision. She had left a good trust fund to a friend to take care of Harry. I would like to have this trust fund.
It was that good.
It was good. It was a good trust fund. And Donna, her friend took it very, very seriously and built a little alcove for him to sit out in the woods, and she had other dogs. And of course, it also reinforced the two ideas. One, dogs are doing amazing work. And yet, I have to say, within a week, Harry was a quite happy dog in his new home, doing very, very well.
Yeah.
And that was important. I think that was important to understand that, yes, they can do this work. Yes, they can do it to an extraordinary degree. They're being asked to do it to an extraordinary – I doubt that would have happened 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah. Do you think it was asking too much of Harry to be her companion in her dying days?
I think it's an epic, almost biblical kind of a decision to make that troubles me, because first it troubled me from the perspective of our society, which is saying, really, humans aren't going to do this, so you're going to have to look elsewhere for it. And I do see a lot of dogs. I mean, any trainer will tell you this. Dogs are stressed. They're poorly trained. They're anxious about all the projections people are putting on them. They don't think. They don't have the wide range of human emotion. The smartest dog is really probably not as smart as the average three-year-old. And it's just important for us to know that, because when we start projecting, asking them to do these things, here's a good example of I was getting in trouble with it because I was starting to see my dog as defying me.
Mm-hmm. And it was personal.
It was personal. He was defying. He's smart. He could lie down. Why wasn't he? And Carolyn began the process of educating me into the idea, no, I just wasn't communicating properly with him. Yeah. He's, you know, defiance is not a dog emotion.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious, too. This is just because your first book was about this relationship that you had with one and then two dogs. Whether... having such an intense relationship with that dog, did that change your relationship with your child, with your daughter?
It reminded me that I did not want to ever see the two as being equivalent, and which I was sometimes drifting towards. Part of my motivation was I don't. You know, a lot of people tell me all the time they get more support from dogs than people. A lot of people tell me that the loss of a pet is the same as the loss of a person. This troubles me, and not because I'm not crazy about dogs, but for the other end. Do we want to be a society that equates the two quite that closely? And I never want my daughter to think that I view her the same way as I view my border collie, who I am. And she always says to me that I know you love the dog more than me, but but that means you love me a lot.
Right.
But I don't want her. She's kidding. I don't want her to. And I certainly don't want my wife. If she were getting more support from the dog than from me, I would really want to know about that. I would want to deal with that.
Because it
would
be a sign that
something was wrong. I would want to deal with that. And I also, from the dog's perspective, the less I've seen him as a human, the better he's been, the calmer he's been, the better trained he's been, the fewer issues we actually have.
Does he sleep with you?
Sometimes. He doesn't. He has the option of doing that. He chooses often not to.
Not to do that. Does
he's
that
busy.
Hurt?
He's busy. I can handle it.
Let me ask you about another group. And this was the Divorced Dogs Club. As it
That's
turned out, it was the women who were getting divorced, but the dogs...
Well, I wandered. I was on one of the walks looking for people for the book, and I met Chester, and and his owner, and she introduced herself as a member of the Divorced Dogs Club, which just completely shocked me. And I said, what is that? Well, she's four of us met walking our dogs. We're all in the process of getting divorced, and we each have a dog who's a male, as it turns out. And they're all males, and we meet once a week. We call ourselves, and we're using the dogs to help us get through this time. And I said, well, can I come to the meeting? There was much discussion about them. And they would open the meetings usually by listing the traits that made dogs superior to men, which was maybe somewhat
uncomfortable.
Also, there was some truth to that. I have to say, you know, the dogs go outside to go to the bathroom, and they like what videos you want. And it was they were I have to say, a great group. They were using dogs, I thought, in a way that was very healthy. They wanted to get back to people. The part I was a little surprised by was a couple of them, when they did reconnect, men didn't like dogs, and they got rid of their dog. Huh? That had actually, these were rescue people called us dogs of convenience. I was surprised by that, that a couple just in the new relationships, the dogs didn't work out, and they were now the dogs are doing fine. But, you know, when you say this dog got me through this period mm-hmm. of life, to me, mm-hmm. that would suggest a kind of loyalty, and yet it didn't work for them. But they were quite a great group, and very funny, very smart, and very courageous about the way they were putting their lives back together. And dogs helping them.
And I was going to say, and you think the dogs did help?
Oh,
them?
Tremendously, tremendously. The dogs were enormous sources of security, for one thing. They said the dogs made them feel safer, literally. They kept them company. They were a source of affection during a time when they didn't feel very, very affectionate. And some of the dogs, of course, did stay on and were very attached. But of course, here's another case where the people and the dogs, in a couple of cases, moved on and all are happy.
That was my 2003 interview with author and dog expert John Katz, who joined me to discuss his book, The New Work of Dogs, Tending to Life, Love, and Family. When we get back, more dog love, as we hear the story of one of America's most famous dogs, Rin Tin Tin. Stay with us.
So brave is Corporal Rusty, though he is just a boy. How true is Private Rin Tin Tin? They are the Army's pride and joy.
This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. We've been hearing about the lives and minds of average dogs this hour, but now we turn to the life and times of one extraordinary dog. From the silent film era through the Second World War, no dog inspired American audiences more than Rin Tin Tin. Author Susan Orlean was first introduced to Rinty as a child by her grandfather, who kept a figurine of the canine movie star on his desk. When she dug deeper, she found that Rin Tin Tin was more than just a pretty face, and that his life story was just as interesting as the movies he starred in. She joined me in 2011 to discuss the importance of this world-class German Shepherd and why his acting chops and athleticism were able to capture the hearts of American audiences during difficult times. Let's listen.
Well, I talked about my TV love affair with Rin Tin Tin, but he goes back to the silent movies and even going back to the beginning of your book to World War One, where he's one of several puppies rescued from a battlefield.
And that fact alone is where I began the book. I mean, having grown up with the Rin Tin Tin show, which came on the year before I was born, but it had infused my entire childhood with passion for German Shepherds and a love of Rin Tin Tin, even though I don't remember specific episodes of the show, all I knew was it was a presence in my life. I think my closest analogy would be almost to a folk melody. It's something that you can't even remember how you heard it or when you heard it. You just always knew it. And that's how I felt about Rin Tin Tin. What I never knew and what set me out on this journey of the book was discovering completely accidentally and absolutely astonishingly that this wasn't just a 1950s TV character, but a real living dog found decades and decades before he was in my life, and who actually, in the inversion of expectation, was a real dog before he became a character, rather than beginning as a character. You know, World War One was the animals' war. There were 16 million animals used in the war, in many different species, but certainly many, many dogs. the Germans used an enormous number of German Shepherds, which were a new breed at the time, and they were the official dog of the German army. And German Shepherds, even though they're so familiar to us, in fact, were developed in the late 1890s. So they were a new breed in 1918 during World War I. The Germans had just been pushed back out of France, and Lee Duncan, a young California kid who was in the war, was sent forward from his barracks to go inspect a battlefield that the Germans had just left behind. This was in the center of France. He saw a building on the battlefield which he recognized as a dog kennel. And because there were so many dogs in the war, there were dog kennels, of course. It was not an unusual sight. It had been hit by artillery. Lee loved animals, and I think that's partly why he went to look at this building and entered it to find many bodies of many dogs that had been killed in the shelling, and then heard a sound in the back and found a female who had just given birth.
And this Rin Tin Tin, whom he eventually trains, and they clearly had this extraordinary bond, but this was an extraordinary dog who could jump 12 feet.
Isn't that amazing?
It is, and I looked at something that was 12 feet, trying to imagine a dog jumping that.
It's incredible, and this was caught on film. He was competing in a dog show in an agility competition. Somebody, a friend of Lee's, was trying out his new slow-motion camera that he had just developed, filmed the dog jumping the incredible wall, and then sold the footage to Movietone News, which is the company that made newsreels that ran before feature films. And of course, it was a huge sensation, and people were wowed. It was a combination of both this athletic feat and the fact that German Shepherds were so unknown in this country and so different looking from the dogs that we had more commonly at the time. This was a different dog. This was a look of a dog that we weren't familiar with. And people went nuts. And the next thing we knew, German Shepherds were quite the rage. When Lee Duncan received a check for Rinty performing in this film, I think for the first time he thought, wow, maybe I can do something with this dog in Hollywood. Who knows? Now, what was going on in Hollywood is important to know to see why it wasn't the craziest thing in the world for him to suddenly go to studios. Namely, that there was a German Shepherd already starring in movies who was making quite a splash. His name was Strongheart, and he was playing the leading man in these dramatic, again, silent films. But there was already somebody presenting a German Shepherd in this heroic leading man role. And there's no question that that inspired Lee and made him think, well, if Strongheart can do it, maybe I can do it too. And my dog, he believed, of course, was better and could do it better and had more charisma. They were seen as rivals immediately. I mean, as soon as Rin Tin Tin started making films, a lot of the reviews compared him
to Strongheart.
And, you know, said, well, Strongheart does this better, but Rin Tin Tin's eyes and ears are more expressive. I mean, they were taken quite seriously as actors. And Rin Tin Tin eventually really pushed Strongheart out of his popularity, and he kind of vanished in obscurity.
Well, and they were stars of silent films, and we should underscore that, because you've got, you know, dogs in a sense competing with actors, you know, for accolades, for attention, for awards, things like that.
And the thing with silent film is that everybody was on a level playing field. People didn't talk and dogs didn't talk. More importantly, dogs look more natural not talking. People with their mouths flapping on silent film look diminished and sometimes could look kind of silly. And dogs, just through gesture and action and expression, told the story. So they were perfectly suited to the medium.
From your objective perspective, was Rin Tin Tin the great star that everyone thought that he was?
He was. You know, he has a lot of charisma. His performances are remarkable. There's a great scene in one of the movies called Clash of the Wolves, where he's basically decided to kill himself. And he's crawling along, and the misery and despair that he's conveying. I mean, no matter how cynical you might be, you watch this and you think, how did they train him to do this? This is incredible. In fact, it was so convincing that Lee had to spend a lot of time explaining to audiences that he was acting. They hadn't hurt him to make him look miserable. He was perfectly fine. He was just performing.
And Rin Tin Tin, as I understand it from reading your book, got the most votes for an Oscar, but was overridden.
The Oscars were a whole new thing at the time. And in the first year, he was the most popular entertainer in the U.S., without question. And in my reporting, I'd found the mention that he had gotten the most votes, but the Academy kind of thought, this is, we're starting this whole new thing here, these Oscars, maybe that wouldn't look that good to have a dog get the first award. So instead, Emil Jannings did get the Best That's Actor funny. Award, the first one ever awarded. I wish it had gone to Rin Tin Tin.
You also write, besides being a very handsome dog and having this charisma, you also say he wasn't very friendly.
Rumor had it that he was not the cuddly dog that you might imagine. Lee never let anyone else handle the dog. They had a completely exclusive relationship, and it worked both ways. Lee's wife at the time divorced him, citing Rin Tin Tin as the co-respondent in her divorce proceedings.
Which is extraordinary.
And it's usually what you know, if someone has a mistress or a lover, you name them as the co-respondent, basically the person responsible for breaking up your marriage. So their relationship, Lee and Rin Tin Tin, was completely exclusive. He didn't want anyone else to become close to the dog, and he was not friendly. A lot of actors claimed he bit them, but everyone around the world who loved him saw in him another quality, and it wasn't necessarily friendliness. It was something heroic, something inspiring, a kind of dramatic loyalty that really wasn't the companion who would snuggle up with you so much as save you.
You also write that when he died in 1932, the nation went into mourning.
An incredible story, because it was still hard for me to really accept the idea that he was as big a star as all of my research led me to believe. And I thought, well, still, he was a dog. Then I come across the reporting about his death. There was a radio bulletin that interrupted programming all across the country reporting that he had died. The next day, there was an hour-long tribute to him that was played all over the country. People hung pictures of him in the windows of theaters and shops as if a great man had passed.
In fact, you quote a United Press bulletin saying, Rin Tin Tin, the greatest of animal motion picture actors, pursued a ghostly villain in a canine happy hunting ground today. This, boy, that takes us back to 1932. Right?
Yes, the writing, it's so interesting how many turns of phrase have become antiques. There ought to be an antique store just for phrases like that.
Exactly.
And it was an amazing sort of time machine to go back and read some of this material. But he was really treated, I mean, it was seen as a huge loss. And I can't imagine that very many other Hollywood figures had that sort of reception when their death was announced, because everybody loved Rin Tin Tin. There was no constituency that didn't somehow feel they could connect with him. And that was particular to him being a dog, I think.
Well, I'm also thinking of this time, you know, the Depression. I mean, this was a tough time for the country between these two wars, which, of course, were a tough time as well.
And the idea that this was the indomitable figure who was always there, who could rise above any challenge.
And even going to the Second World War, you write that people sent their dogs to war. In the Second World War.
Yes, and this was an amazing piece of what feels to me sort of lost history. The U.S. Army had never developed a canine corps, even though all the other countries in World War I, for instance, Britain, France, Germany, Belgium, they all used dogs. The U.S. had never been convinced of the efficacy of dogs in war. And in fact, at the time World War II began, the entire U.S. canine corps consisted of 6 huskies in Alaska. And that was it. We just didn't have... In the meantime, the Germans had developed an enormous dog army, and the French and British as well. The U.S., though, suddenly, after Pearl Harbor, there was a real change of heart, a feeling that we needed dogs. We needed them immediately. And in fact, we needed 300,000 dogs immediately. And of course, they had to be adults, although I love the idea of 300,000 puppies being gathered and sent to Europe. It would have changed the war for sure. But where do you get 300,000 adult dogs? I mean, there was only one choice, which was to turn to the American public and ask them to donate their dogs. Rin Tin Tin was the spokesman for that program and was used to inspire. He enlisted, got his serial number tattooed on his foreleg, and would make public appearances, appeared in public service announcements, and the American public responded. People sent their dogs. There was no way to know whether the dog would come back, whether the dog would be killed in combat, whether if the dog were returned, it would be changed by the experience. But the support for the war effort and the knowledge that dogs were going to be tremendously useful was widespread, and the dogs came flooding in. In fact, the army centers that had been set up to receive the dogs actually were at full capacity.
You know, I was thinking about the dogs that are, or the dog types, I guess, that are featured in films today. You know, the Marley and Me, the bad dog syndrome, or the goofy dog. I mean,
right.
they seems like they sort of operate in a different part of the culture today.
You know, dogs became comic figures, and we really haven't had a heroic dog figure or, you know, that kind of strong, able dog figure for some time. I think that's partly that the culture moved away from these sort of heroic figures in general. This sounds funny, but in a way, we've infantilized dogs.
Made them our babies, right?
Yeah, dressing them in, you know, ridiculous dog fashion. And
baby carriages.
And, you know, it's funny because it parallels a really decadent trope in Victorian culture where dogs had wedding gowns and calling cards, and proper dogs had full, you know, had tuxedos and suits, and they were had marriages. And it was crazy. And that kind of infantilizing or treating them like dolls, which isn't really, dogs aren't dolls. They're dogs.
Exactly.
And I think that culture, for better or worse, is cyclical. And it seems to me quite likely that we will move back out of this. And dogs are in service in so many interesting ways, in search and rescue, in the military, in... You know, dogs are being trained to detect cancer. They work as therapy dogs. They are heroic. And I think that we're perhaps ready again to see them more in that role.
That was my 2011 interview with author Susan Orlean about her book, Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend. And that wraps up the dog edition of Radio Times in Review. Send us an email. Tell us what you think. WHYY.org/Radio Times. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, who edits Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks for listening.
And Private Rin Tin Tin.